process so powerful is that we are tapping into collective pain and joy by sharing our experiences and providing the space to hold it. Feeling the Blues: The Politics of Vulnerability. I'm guilty at times of running from vulnerability. Whoever is vulnerable, at risk, disposable, and dispensable is at the heart of the politics of vulnerability. Our identities matter, and safety about who we are vulnerable with is important. Should I be vulnerable with white men who fear me? Should I be vulnerable with police who dehumanize me? These questions are important for us to weave the connection to how vulnerability can cultivate healing-centered engagement with young people. Studies of vulnerability in general have examined a range of disabling qualities and diminished capacities resulting from a place of helplessness or shortcoming. Brené Brown came along and completely changed the game, showing us the power that can come from discovering vulnerability in our personal and professional lives. But I'm also mindful that there is a politics of vulnerability when working with youth. Some of us can afford to be more vulnerable than others. Power, privilege, security are all conditions that can affect who is vulnerable, the consequences of being vulnerable, and what we gain from being vulnerable in our relationships with young people. So we also have to understand how issues of race, gender identity, social class, and power all determine the consequences of our vulnerability. The Blues taught me everything I needed to know about the politics of vulnerability, so let's return to the blues. The blues is an art form with roots in the Deep South. It is born from spirituals, chants, work songs, and field hollers created by enslaved Africans. The music evolved into revivalist hymns and folk music. At the heart of the blues are stories that convey suffering and joy, struggles and triumph, pain and pleasure. What makes the blues so powerful is that the artist can connect to the lyrics from some deep personal experience. So when B.B. King belts out, "The Thrill Is Gone," he's singing from a lived experience, the pain of going through heartbreak and the joy of coming out on the other side. It's a type of emotional vulnerability, but the blues was also shaped by structural vulnerability, the laws, policies, and values that create oppression and suffering. The fact that the blues originated on southern plantations in the 19th century is in itself an example of structural vulnerability. Structural vulnerability means that some groups in our society, racial, gendered, social class, religious, are likely to experience some form of social misery, like poverty. Social misery is not just an individual experience, but a collective one. Yet these two forms of vulnerability, structural and emotional, work together. Structural vulnerability, poverty, gender marginalization, racial oppression, fuels and produces collective emotional harm and shared psychological injury, the ingredients for emotional vulnerability. Now here is the point. In order to transform structural vulnerability, we need to tap into our emotional vulnerability. This is what I learned in my work with young people over the years. I have kept this in mind in all of my interactions with Black youth, personally and professionally. I always ask myself three questions. Being the Blues: Creating Healing-Centered Engagement. 1. Am I practicing vulnerability in my relationships with people and communities I care about? Sometimes we engage in youth work from a distance and are not close enough with people to practice vulnerability. Nearly every issue I care about, youth voice, racism, trauma, criminal justice, was born out of a deep relationship with someone who taught me more than I thought I knew about the topic. This meant sitting in a circle with young Black men on probation and listening to their stories, or spending time in a men's correctional facility and learning about compassion, or sitting at the kitchen table with mothers who are so stressed from daily doses of trauma. When we share our stories, we connect in ways that build bonds of understanding. 2. Have I created a safe container for vulnerability? Building the container for vulnerability is just as important as vulnerability itself. It's important to assess if it's relatively safe enough to practice vulnerability. This is tricky on the one hand because vulnerability, by its very nature, means social-emotional risk-taking. It means that there is something at stake when you share something that matters. On the other hand, if it is too safe, then there is no risk and therefore no growth in the relationship. The important thing to ask is, will I or could I be harmed by sharing this? If the answer is yes, then you should rethink participating. But if the container is cultivated correctly, you'll feel safe enough to share because you've already considered if the person or group has earned the right to hear your story. 3. Can I make the adequate time commitment? Young people know when we aren't keeping it real and often feel disrespected when we fail to live up to our commitments. Your job is to first be honest with yourself about your capacity to go on the journey with young people. Once you make a commitment to create space to share their stories in an intentional way, this cultivates the healing we need in our work with youth. We all have stories that can heal ourselves, young people, and our society. We just need the time and space to share them. So, open up your favorite music app and listen to the blues for a while. You'll find that if you really feel, these stories of raw vulnerability can connect your own story of joy, pleasure, sadness, with young people. These are the things that make us human. And if we make space enough in our lives to listen to young people, we can find the real secret to our own transformation, which is, of course, the only real way we change the world.
Sean A. Jenright, Ph.D., is one of the nation's leading innovators, provocateurs, and thought leaders on African American youth, youth activism, and youth development. He is a professor of education in the Africana Studies Department and a senior research associate at San Francisco State University.
Filling every page with joy, rewriting trauma and shame. Read and written by Kaya Nadira. I can do all things through spite, which strengthens me, was a motto I lived by for most of my life. I had pushed myself through high school and college and boys and girls and gender and queerness by using my trauma as kindling for the massive inferno brewing in the pit of my stomach. I thought vengeance would save me. I was motivated by the constant thought of seeing my abusers, my harm-doers, watch me shine. And I wanted that shine to burn them. Resilience wasn't enough. Every time I got up, I was knocked down or pushed down or violated or gaslit because I went into the world armed with only my strength. Just be resilient, my mother always said. And I was. I held my chin up to the storm, but it still knocked me on my ass. I was living in a world that was constantly taking from me. My bodily autonomy, my agency, my joy, taken from me. So I clung to spite. I clung to my anger and I gave it credit for every aspect of my success. I became obsessed with and comfortable in my bitterness because I somehow thought the reward would be joy. I ignored the rot and decay oozing from my spirit and learned to smile and speak and live as if I did not have this rage deep inside me. I felt myself turn to ash and float away in the wind. Deep down, I knew the reward for my bitterness would only beget bitterness because when you're living in rage, nothing is ever enough. Something is always missing. I wondered if I did not have this anger living so deep in the pit of my belly and rooted in my soul, what did I have? What I should have been asking was, what did I want? That was something I hadn't considered in years. I had no concept of what I wanted my survivorship to look like because the truth was, I didn't want to survive. I had always thought there was a cap on how long I could hold all this inside and still live. I knew I'd reach my breaking point one day, but until then I planned to patiently wait to die while engaging in as much recklessness as I could to speed up the process. My therapist called this mania, I called it life. Not many people know about my diagnosis. I tend to place parts of myself, of my life, into vaults, locking them away to hide from the world. I always thought I had a certain air of general insanity about me, but being diagnosed with bipolar 1 disorder when I was just 21 was the nail in the coffin for me. I felt like God's favorite broken toy because surely he must have been up there fucking with me. A life constantly enduring was not a life I ever wanted for myself. But what did I want? What did I need? The truth is I had no clue. I certainly didn't expect the life that I have. I didn't expect the trauma that I would experience and eventually have to face. None of it. Isn't it a drag that we have to pay the price for other people's hurt? That we have to bear the weight of the trauma that they inflict on us? I suppose what I want is simple. I want a life and a body that feels like mine. I want to feel at home in myself. My goal for survivorship is just to feel whole. I don't feel like that's too much to ask. When I was assaulted by one of my close friends, in an attempt to spare his feelings and at my own expense, I downplayed the assault. "I'm fine," I told him. I assured him that I didn't feel assaulted, and at the end of our conversation, I hugged him because it seemed right at the time. I should not have confronted him so soon, or on my own. I pretended I could be in his presence without feeling ill, that his physical touch didn't fill my whole being with disgust, with rage. The more I pushed these feelings down, the harder that fire in me burned, and somehow the person who deserved to see and feel that anger the most was never the target. Something about that filled me with more shame than my actual assault. Even if I could get over being violated, I cannot get over the fact that I let him get away with it. I was disgusted by my own passive attitude. Why did I reach out to him? Why did I go to his room? Why didn't I speak up? Why did I continue to add to my burdens just to give him peace of mind? I think I know the answer, but that's a hard truth to accept. The truth here in general was hard to accept. I had spent years dodging so many hurdles and carefully stepping around certain memories so that I never had to think about my first assault. I had carefully crafted myself into a person this could never happen to again. I was smart, charming, a perfectionist, wholesome, acceptably available, but not so accessible that men could feel entitled. And yet here I was again. There is nothing you can do to take the target off your back when that is literally the way systems are designed. When you survive something once already, you'd think that'd be the end of it, but somehow, despite all my work, I was here again. I'd rather pretend it doesn't exist and accept that. What I should have been blaming was a patriarchal society that does not focus on teaching people about consent from a young age. I should have been blaming a careless and thoughtless young man who actually harmed someone. But I was used to carrying way too much baggage, and it was just easier to blame myself. The shame over the price I was paying for the hurt other people inflicted on me, over the weight of the trauma they inflicted on me, led me to shut down. I was too angry to focus on school, so I dropped out. I was too angry to focus on living, so I stopped trying. I stopped trying to explore and find myself sexually because I had come to some deep understanding that I was never going to be a real person to anyone. I was a toy. A doll to be played with. Undeserving of my own pleasure. I was simply to be used and discarded, and that made the rage inside of me swell even more. When I did speak of my assault, one of the three times I allowed myself to name the harm inflicted on me, I spoke of it as if it happened to someone else, because I could not cope with the truth that I was now a two-time survivor of sexual assault. Imagine you are a child with no understanding of the world, and the first thing you ever really believed about yourself is that you were complicit in your own abuse. I was 21 the first time I saw someone face any consequences for causing me harm. During that time, a friend of mine got me a job at the club they were working at as a stripper. Before I went in for an official audition, I decided to visit and see what a strip club was even like. I fell in love the moment I entered. In the center of the room was a stage with a scary-looking two-story high pole flooded in red and blue lights. Not long after I took a seat at the edge of the stage, my friend went on. I was in awe of how confident and fluid they were. How they walked around the stage oozing sex appeal, commanding attention from every person in the club. I knew a few things to be true about my friend. The most important being that, like me, they were a dark-skinned, non-binary trans person. How could they, in the shrine to the cishet male ego, hold power? I had no idea how, but I was determined to find the answers. So I showed up the following Monday in my finest Victoria's Secret teddy and heeled boots, certainly not prepared, but ready to learn the secret these women had. Being a stripper was the best decision I ever made. And I'll say that with pride until the day I die. At a time when I was completely losing myself, stripping made me feel grounded. I learned to be bold and decisive. I became disciplined and I became so fucking confident. In stripping, I saw myself as sexy for the first time. I felt powerful and capable. I learned to do exceptional things with my body. I could amaze a crowd with acrobatic stunts that seemed impossible to others, but effortless for me. I could empty a grown man's bank account in an hour and a half of pure fantasy built just for him. I learned that the secret we as sex workers have is that we are simply magicians. Despite what is weighing on our hearts and minds, we do our jobs and put on a show. I was not the only one pushing through so much. Through sex work, I figured out that I am not flawed, but I am human. So I worked until the confidence and grace I conjured on stage could be conjured on demand, and from there could just be a part of my daily life. If I could hold power in there, I could have that power anywhere. That was the secret. Pole dancing was a huge part of the transformation I went through that helped me discover myself as a person. I came into this work with the same mindset with which I was walking through life. I was just a toy, but at least I was being paid for it. It was an unhelpful and frankly toxic mindset to have when entering this field. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely tricks. That's the motto. At Fuego's, I learned I was no doll. In a world ruled by cishet norms, where cis male pleasure was centered, a Black, dark-skinned, queer, non-binary person managed to find and hold power. Great power. I felt like I had turned the system against itself. Although I loved my job so much, I was still reminded daily of the real world. During one of the slower days, I accepted a customer's request for a dance. He decided to pull out his penis while I was dancing. I immediately disassociated. I could see myself falling to the sunken place survivors know all too well. That place where we store our deepest memories. That place where our triggers lie waiting to absorb us into a state of paralysis. It happened so suddenly. Before I could pull myself out of it or curse him out, the club security guard snatched him up and beat the shit out of him. At that moment, I felt protected. It was the first time someone brought harm to me and someone else intervened. It was the first time someone cared enough to act. This isn't to say that no one ever cared that I was abused, but it was the first time someone did anything about it. Watching that creep get grabbed in response to trespassing my boundaries was the most empowering moment of my young life. Shame is a nasty feeling. It feels like being the spaghetti sauce-stained Tupperware in the set. Shame envelops your entire being and leaves you completely helpless. I never fully understood disgust until I understood shame. It's like this feeling of dread, like standing on a stage and watching the lights, every single one, turn off all around you until you are swallowed by darkness. Shame can feel like your greatest enemy and your only friend. Shame can feel like a burial for your sins, but you're the only one who cared enough to be in attendance. And shame can feel like a betrayal, a vicious and hateful betrayal that can't be forgiven or forgotten. I was born queer. I came out of the womb a brilliant and unforgiving burst of light with a rainbow beautiful enough to make God cry. While I never had the language to identify, I always knew who I was. I never knew it was something I had to announce until I was old enough to realize people talked and had opinions about business that was not theirs to mind. I was in eighth grade when I first felt the pull of what I believed to be love. She was a cute little church girl who gave me butterflies in the pit of my tummy. When her parents drove us to the church on Valentine's Day, we held pinkies in the back seat. It was our own little sign of rebellion, a silent revolution in the darkness. It was a harmless puppy love. Two kids dreaming of freedom, life in the big city, new lives, adulthood, and a love we knew nothing of but were so incredibly curious about. I've never been the type to hide in the shadows about anything. I was raised not to. My feelings were my feelings, and I felt them in their entirety. Then I shared those feelings at the kitchen table with my mother and my aunt. I didn't understand the fear or the disgust I saw until the weight of that shame hit me. I was not sure what or how, but I had done something wrong. It was evidenced by the way my aunt leaned away from me immediately. It was clear in the way my mother spoke to me, in the silence that crept throughout the house in the days to follow. I had made a mistake. I had done something that made me wicked. I had committed an offense so heinous, my aunt never uttered a word to me again. For a long time, I was conflicted. I had been raised to be fearless and bold. I was taught to be unafraid of the truth and to embrace that actions have consequences. But when I spoke the truth, the consequences confused me. Was I wrong for being who I am and for sharing that with the people I love? I was told that I'd lose love, acceptance, religion, and family for choosing my queerness, for choosing my happiness. At that moment, I became afraid of the truth. I lived in a world where I was constantly ridiculed by the people around me. To be unaccepted by my peers and then rejected by my family was the worst heartbreak I'd ever known. I lived in fear of experiencing that feeling again. Shame turned my fear of rejection against me. I was afraid to share, afraid to open up, afraid to reach out, and especially afraid to trust. It wasn't that I lost a desire to. It was that when I tried, my throat felt thick and the words felt impossible. I felt physically held back from speaking my truth. Even though I fought for my queerness, I still felt shame and fear. When I came out as non-binary at 19, I deeply expected the same reaction from my mother. But I was attempting to abandon my fear of the truth. I needed to be free. I was tired of living as myself and as the woman I used to be. That woman was gone by that point. But I knew that whatever dreams rooted in womanhood anyone had had for me were gone, and everyone else needed to know as well. Just like I fought for my queerness, I would fight for my gender. Not many Black folks in my community know about being non-binary. My mother had some understanding of it from literal arguments we had had in the past about my then-favorite rapper, Angel Hayes, an agender masterpiece. She had also had a better understanding of it from her job at the time, dealing with queer and genderqueer youth. Despite the progress I knew had been made, I was still terrified. What if I was pushing her too far? What if this was the thing that made her stop loving me? I pushed it aside, remembering that she'd always told me nothing I do could ever separate me from her love. And so I told her the truth. She stared dead at me and just said, "Okay, cool." That was it. The only follow-up question was, "So that's they-them, right?" Somehow that scared me even more. I was already so defensive, I could not understand why she was not. I prepared myself for battle and she showed up unarmed, just ready to love me like always. There is no easy way to describe shame. In fact, most of my troubles with this work came from trying to find some easy but impactful way to describe this beast of an emotion. Shame is sick and twisted. I know that. I know that shame feels like an impossible labyrinth of misdeeds and bad choices. But more than anything, I know shame is a different monster for us all. My shame is insidious. It stacks my mistakes on top of another until I'm so overwhelmed I'm crushed by them, just suffocating under the weight. I think worse than feeling the shame, though, is feeling the shame alone. Just as much as shame is limiting, it's so incredibly isolating, at least for me. And it's not just this feeling of no one understanding what I'm going through. It's the idea that no one will ever love me because of the mistakes I have made. It is a lie I tell myself that because I have so many skeletons in my closet, someone will find me disgusting or unworthy. And I've stuck to this belief because it is the only truth I've ever embraced. I am branded by my mistakes. I am certified damaged goods, and no one needs that. I am still struggling now, not in a grand or intense way, but a silent tug of war in my subconscious. I was recently in a toxic, abusive relationship. In this relationship, I was with someone who lied to me and emotionally manipulated and gaslit me. They eventually put their hands on me. It isn't something I'm proud of. When the abuse began, I kept that side of them from my friends. I was never a dull person, and deep down, I was aware I was being manipulated. But when you spent most of your life embracing the idea that everyone is always going to hate you, and any suffering you endure is punishment for one of the countless wrongs you've committed in the past, it's hard to believe it can get much better. I was 21 and in love. In love with an idea despite their many empty promises, despite what they showed me to be true of them. And when you are in love, you stick it out. You fix the problem and you fix them. And I was going to fix them because I was beyond saving. For nearly 8 months, I ignored friends who saw the red flags and begged me to realize I deserved more. I dealt with embarrassing outbursts in front of friends and told them the same excuses I told myself. They're just like that sometimes. We're working on it. They've got a lot going on. I'm sorry, y'all. This may be my biggest skeleton. How do I explain to people whom I want to date moving forward that you cannot touch me suddenly because I will panic? How do I explain that I'm absolutely terrified when someone yells because I'm unsure of what will happen next? How do I explain when the next person I date claims they'll never hurt me that I don't believe them because memories of the past constantly repeat in my head like a broken record? Because the last person who claimed they would never hurt me pushed my body to the ground and kept me there until I agreed to stay with them. These are not things you overcome easily, and so I keep that close to my chest. Because when I try to share them, that choking feeling comes. My throat feels impossibly small and I close back up. My body won't allow me to let it out or let it go. The truth is, I will always be a survivor. I will always wonder who I could have been if I had not been so traumatized so early. There will always be something that I will have to overcome, and truthfully, I think that's okay. Being a survivor is now a badge of honor for me. I can say with pride that I did more than power through, and I am doing more than surviving. I am living. At least, I'm living life to the fullest I can. Vengeance is not my savior because I saved myself. Dancing saved me. My community saved me. Love saved me. When I shifted my thinking a little bit more from a victim mindset to embracing survivorship, I had so much more respect for the strength I had shown, but I also realized that it was time to stop carrying everything alone. My queer/trans family saved me more than anything. I am eternally grateful for the chosen family that saw me at my lowest and still loved me, for people who showed up whenever and wherever without complaint. Without them, I never would have realized that I wasn't alone. Without them, I would have never released the death grip I had on my anger and started really thinking about what was next for me. Thanks to them, I have an entirely new blank chapter to write, and I plan on filling every page with joy.
Kaya Nadira, they, he, is a filmmaker and photographer originally from Alabama. Their photography can be seen in publications like Salty, Glamour, Les Inrecoupables, and USA Today. They currently reside in Brooklyn, New York, and are looking forward to the next adventure.
Honoring Our Stories, Transforming Our Pain. Written and read by Duran Young. We don't talk enough about racial trauma in this country. In fact, even as a therapist and facilitator, I found myself stunned one fateful day when my son came home from kindergarten crying. When I asked what happened, he replied, "I wish I was white like everybody else." I froze. I didn't know what to say or do. I thought to myself, when did this happen? How did this happen? What did I miss? I spun into a shame-guilt spiral. I'm the founder of Black Therapist Rock, for goodness sake. I've really messed up somewhere along the way if my own kid wants to be white. My son further explained that during recess, one of his white friends didn't want to play with him and said, "Brown kids aren't as fun as playing with other kids." A few hours later, after recovering from the shock of the statement, I hid in a corner to wipe my own tears and slowly regain my parental bearings. I realized that what mattered most was that he was able to give words to his sadness. Even at his young age, he was able to do something that I struggled to do as an adult. He spoke truth to power. The last thing he needed was for me to be overwhelmed with shame or guilt. What he did need was for me to be with him in this familiar yet overwhelming pain so that he didn't have to carry it alone. I needed to not only reaffirm his inherent worth and value, but also validate that what he had experienced was racism and that it was not just in his head. It was real, and so was the emotional impact. I'm glad that my son trusted me with this pain and felt connected enough to share his experience. The very definition of trauma is that we are in it alone with little or no emotional support to make meaning of critical life-altering experiences. Together, we did some deep breathing and grounding, and I realized that he had activated the little girl in me who probably experienced a similar feeling but had to hide it. Growing up in Wichita Falls, Texas, where the KKK had held quarterly rallies and publicly burned crosses as a form of visual intimidation, I had learned to cope through silence. My mother was extremely pro-Black, but definitely not anti-white. She was more pro-people. She talked about historic Black leaders constantly. I believe this may have been the saving grace of my race socialization. However, because we were surrounded by violence and chaos in the projects, on top of her personal struggles with drug addiction and untreated mental illness, I felt she didn't have time to be bothered with my little feelings and questions about my environment. So I did what most of us do. I learned to numb my feelings so that I could work twice as hard to make something of myself. Working twice as hard leaves us chronically exhausted and emotionally unavailable to ourselves or anyone else. We then raise children who feel emotionally neglected. As a mother, I acknowledge the emotional weight of parenting Black children. I imagine it's the same psychological burden our enslaved ancestors carried. Racial trauma is a psychological result of having to navigate white supremacy culture in a body that is made to feel inferior. It makes us feel trapped in our own skin. It makes us feel as though we are suffocating and choking on hundreds of daily messages filled with shame. This includes humiliating events at work, having to have the talk with our teenagers about driving while Black, and the vicarious trauma of witnessing public murders of Black and brown bodies. Collectively, we armor up to function in this environment, leaving the trauma misunderstood and misdiagnosed. This protective armor creates steel cages around our hearts and significantly reduces our capacity for healthy connections, both inside and out. We can't live a wholehearted life without connection. Experiencing love, joy, belonging requires us to be with our feelings. We can't heal if we continue to pretend we aren't hurting. Hurt people hurt people. In America, because of our history, we are all hurting. As a country, the story we collectively make up is that feelings and people don't matter. We turn to this story because believing it is easier than the risk of feeling and connecting. When we don't have healthy connections, we learn how to navigate the world in isolation, which isn't really living, just merely functioning. Sometimes I talk about vulnerable things, but don't allow myself to feel vulnerable. If it's not connecting me to more of who I am, if it's not coming from this deep, vulnerable place in my heart, is it really connection? If it's coming from my head or if I have an agenda behind it, is it really connecting? Certified Daring Way facilitator Dr. LaDonna Butler states, vulnerability, the state of showing up, unarmored, shaking, yet willing to embrace the benefit and consequence of human relationship, sometimes feels counterintuitive as a Black person. Our collective internal protection mechanisms are transmitted strategies of survival that we inherited from our ancestors. However, vulnerability in the face of racial trauma challenges the operating systems of oppression. It illuminates the sheer power of our presence, the truth of our existence as equitable partners in humanity. When I'm being vulnerable with myself about all of my life experiences, I remember why I had to armor up in the first place. By honoring my pain, I can take inventory and decide which of these methods of protection I need in this moment and which I can leave behind. I have more choices and more liberation around how I show up with other people. Racism threatens our ability to set healthy boundaries by silencing us and calling our experiences and realities into question. This is especially true when you grow up in poverty or when there are multiple layers of oppression like homophobia, transphobia, fatphobia, ableism, sexism, classism, Islamophobia, or xenophobia. The layers of otherness smother and silence our voices. Through this silence, other forms of trauma go unchecked and unspoken, including multiple forms of abuse. In recent years, I have learned what it means to go inside, and I realize why a part of me felt that it was dangerous, overwhelming, and inconceivable because of my childhood sexual abuse. Sexual abuse robs us from connection to ourselves, especially to our bodies. When we become disconnected from our bodies, it impacts us throughout life. When we live in households filled with shame, there are secrets we hold, and we are taught to ignore whatever it is we think we need, especially when we need help. Living in a Black body, asking for help is one of the most vulnerable things we can do. Code switching, which I learned to do very early in my life, is a survival strategy that requires you to push away parts of who you are and overfunction in other parts. We create all these roles to try to control the impact of racism, to tame it and change ourselves, trying to get on the good side of racism by being the model Black person. There are so many things that we do to shape our whole lives around these internal messages of you are not good enough and you are unworthy. Carrying the burden of silence, racial trauma, and shame is exhausting and soul-crushing. Shame resilience, according to Brené Brown, is the ability to practice authenticity when we experience shame, to move through the experience without sacrificing our values, to come out on the other side of the shame experience with more courage, compassion, and connection than we had going into it. We can affirm ourselves once we realize that we are inherently worthy of basic human rights, and we begin to understand that the system is sick, not us. Critical awareness and the intentional refusal to internalize oppressive messages are necessary to develop shame resilience. In my work, I found that it is very common for Black people to think that discussing emotion is selfish and a waste of time. Why? Because it's not going to change my reality. It's not going to put food on the table. It is not going to help me survive. A lot of times we think, I'm feeling sorry for myself, and where's that going to get me? I am just going to feel more victimized if I actually allow myself to feel these things. That is the fear, that the emotion will take over or overwhelm us, that we will lose emotional control. That's a very real fear when you still have to wake up in the morning and pretend you're not depressed, worried, or outraged. We think we're going to get stuck and drown in it, and we're going to be overwhelmed by it. Who has time for that? Ain't nobody got time for that. When I advise someone to go to therapy or talk about feelings or even just journal, my recommendations are often disregarded because I'm retired military and have all the privilege and economic access that comes with being middle class. I understand that many people feel they are too busy working to keep food on the table and a roof over their heads and trying not to get shot by the cops. They often feel most of their time is focused on trying to survive, and there will never be any time available for them to be vulnerable. However, scarcity is a mindset that there will never be enough. It goes beyond our present experience and projects forward to wreak havoc on our future long before it arrives. Anytime you hear the words should, never, can't, or always, look for raw materials of scarcity, shame, comparison, and disengagement. External constraints are very real for the 8.1 million Black Americans living in poverty. Even among the middle class, some are just a few paychecks away from being homeless. Because of the very real poverty brought on by generations of systemic racism, many of us are brought up to believe that vulnerability is a costly privilege that we simply can't afford to give to ourselves or our loved ones. So we hide behind our shame shields, attempting to protect ourselves and one another. A life filled with fear and hypervigilance makes it difficult to trust anyone, including ourselves. A lot of us don't trust our family, our parents, or other Black people. We have been taught that Black is bad or wrong, and we often carry this self-limiting, unconscious belief about ourselves and one another. Shadon McCants, another certified facilitator in the Daring Way, explains it as a legacy burden that makes it hard to kumbaya in a world that hates me for the color of my skin, the texture of my hair, the bass in my voice, and the will to want to live the American dream. In white supremacy culture, it's a dog-eat-dog world, and everybody is fighting for as much privilege as they can possibly get. Vulnerability is seen as weak and for suckers. acknowledging the impact of racism on your life is like walking into a big, dark, murky cave. You know that once you go in there, you're not going to be able to see. You're not going to know where you're going or what you will find. But you walk in anyway because you know that there are things in that cave that you need to reclaim. Things that have been taken from you. You walk in, despite the fear, to reclaim your ability to speak up and say what you need, to be seen and heard, and to take up space. As a Black woman, it feels like an act of resistance to have an intentional life, to say that my life is going to be meaningful, to live out the mantra of Black Lives Matter. Living in constant fear that your life could end at any moment, your future orientation is cut short, and the capacity for hope is often reduced. I have great compassion for the parts of me that didn't want to hope or dream because they carried a deep fear of disappointment. I had to admit that deep down inside, I had been carrying years of anger and despair. Patriarchy has created a culture in which men aren't allowed to feel, and women are often punished for doing so publicly. Avoiding emotions has resulted in abuse of power in many forms and at many levels. In our facilitation training, we talk about how it's very difficult to ask people to set down their armor and be vulnerable when racism and white supremacy demands armor. We talk about how this is especially true for Black men. I've been pondering the statement, and I've actually been asking Black men what they need for their healing. Here is what Ty Kuttner, a men's personal development coach, shared. I can't name a lonelier, less cared for, more feared group in America than the Black man. The stereotype promoted in the media for hundreds of years has been that the Black man is dangerous. Is it possible to build a relationship with someone you consciously or unconsciously fear? Black men even fear each other, reducing the chances of emotional connection, trust, social support, or community. We live in a country that's hostile toward us, increasing our loneliness. We don't feel valued when we can't provide for our families. And since our ability to provide is limited, we often carry a sense of low self-worth. Most of us are extremely lonely. Who can Black men truly be vulnerable with? I think the answer for all of us is that we have to start by owning our pain and being deeply vulnerable with ourselves first. We must each uncover our own inner wisdom. This is what the Sankofa means to me. Sankofa is a word from the Twi language of Ghana that translates as go back and get it. The Sankofa is a metaphorical symbol used by the Akan people of Ghana, generally pictured as a bird, with its head turned backward, taking an egg from its back. It expresses the importance of reaching back to knowledge learned in the past and bringing it into the present to make positive progress. I believe we should all honor and be amazed by our own stories and the connected heritage of those who came before us. I'm amazed that all of my ancestors survived long enough for me to simply exist in the world. The struggle and hope that allowed me to be here means that my life has meaning and it matters. Maya Angelou said it best. I believe we feel safest when we go inside ourselves and find home, a place where we belong and maybe the only place we really do. This is where our vulnerability starts, in the home inside of us. During my childhood, I experienced frequent relocations and long periods of homelessness. I didn't have the sense of home that I'm having to create as an adult. As descendants of people who were stolen from their homeland, we often have difficulty finding our way back home. In 2009, I made my first of many trips to Ghana, West Africa. Something inside of me healed when I walked through the door of return, a monument that acknowledges the destruction of the transatlantic slave trade. Living in Ghana for 6 months the following year was the first time in my life that I experienced a deep feeling of community support and consistent joy. I was home, physically and emotionally. I believe that corrective experiences and relational connections outline the path of healing. When I went into the slave dungeons in Ghana, I remember putting my hand on the walls and purposely and intentionally wanting to bear witness to the suffering of our ancestors. This deep-seated pain that we collectively still carry in our DNA is rarely acknowledged and has yet to be accounted for and repaired. For me, reparations would be fully funding our healing. When I came back to the United States, I knew that I wanted to help more Black people experience joy and pride around Blackness in the midst of white supremacy culture. I created the nonprofit Black Therapists Rock 6 years later to start to create community and connection among Black healers who often are dealing with their own racial trauma as well as professional isolation. One of my favorite quotes is an African proverb: if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. We must come together to heal. Our village is counting on it.
Duran Young is a mom, retired Air Force social worker, and founder of Black Therapists Rock. Her international clinical experience inspires her passion for cross-cultural compassion. She emphasizes communal healing to resolve mental health issues stemming from historical trauma and systemic oppression. Running Out of Gas, Sonya Renee Taylor. In early December 2012, a month after my mother's death, I sat in Sean's tight kitchen, my wide hips spilling over the sides of his sleek chrome stools. Before me, swirling in the belly of a spotless wine glass, was a Cabernet Merlot blend he had poured generously from an elegant carafe. Sean always poured his bottles of red wine into carafes first, so they might open properly, as he put it. The walls of the kitchen were a bright sunflower yellow whose contrast against the carafe intensified the blood plum color of the wine. I lifted the glass from the table, stared into its deep garnet well, and thought of my own hauled blood flow each month. I thought of my mother's blood that once emptied out with the new moon, just as my own was soon to do, as her mother's had done and her mother before her, and so on. A legacy of emptying. I thought about how I had rested in Terry's womb as she rested in her mother's womb. How I had always been with my mommy before she was even fully with herself. Then I thought of the mortician draining the rich red wine from my mommy's body before filling her with a foreign mephitic liquid, something that likely tasted of toxins and tannins. My mother died on a Thursday in late October, but began dying long before that. We hadn't spoken regularly in months, not since she started drinking in the mornings, making my "is she sober" calculations unreliable. We were the same woman, Terry and I, always looking for a way out of ourselves inside something else, whether it be brown liquor or brown bodies. Too often, this is what the world gives Black women: escape hatches to nowhere, tunnels that empty into our same fractured lives. Rarely any roots to care or a soft someplace, just the thud of falling back into the same shit we've been trying to get out of. My mother and I were a mirror loop of shame, circling our own addictions only to end up staring at the other, which was to be staring at ourselves. I'd spent every year after my 10th birthday patchworking an identity that might one day make my crack-addicted mother stay and care for me. And Terry spent every year after my 10th birthday running from the demons that made it impossible for her to care for her children. In our loops, we just kept running into our fears and away from the one thing that might have saved us both: love. Sean stood in front of the stove, stirring the onions and potatoes he was preparing, along with the prime cuts of steak on broil in the oven. He was not a man fluent in the verbal exchanges of intimacy, but for nearly 20 years, Sean had cared for me like this, with wine and dinners. Short, dark-skinned, impeccably groomed, well-dressed, good-smelling, he fancied himself worldly. A Renaissance man.
I would not begrudge him the title. My first dining experience at a restaurant with white linen tablecloths and coiffed male servers who pulled out my chair and rid the table of breadcrumbs using little plastic shovels happened on a date with Sean. He was a Black man who introduced me to discriminating wines, authentic reggae, and morbid videos like Faces of Death. In the early years of our friendship, we would lounge on the couch of his college apartment and watch these twisted videos, a cocky skydiver descending over a river of alligators, only to short his landing by a few feet and wind up chum in their snapping jaws. Two bottles of wine and six captured on film deaths later, we relocated to his bedroom and unceremoniously had sex. The sex occurred as an act of happenstance in our friendship, like a side effect of our genitals being in a shared vicinity. Getting naked was never presented as the intention of our time together. To consciously pair sex with our friendship would be to admit we were more than friends, admit we owed each other some truth. Neither Sean nor I was in the truth-telling business. I suppose it was ironic that we met as co-workers for a teen pregnancy prevention and education peer program. We were 19 and 20, both hired to teach safer sex, communication, and decision-making skills for middle and high school kids. A staple of the curriculum was role plays designed to help students differentiate between passive, aggressive, and assertive communication styles. Sean was often cast as the aggressive boyfriend attempting to pressure me, his pretend girlfriend, into being sexual with him. My task was to use my assertive communication techniques to diffuse the peer pressure. Sean reveled in his villainy, committed to fraying my assertive reserve. He played dirty, stuffing grapes from the day's lunch platter in my mouth mid-sentence while moving his body so close to my own that the electric field of our attraction would short-circuit my access to language. He was a fausseur, a master persuader who made me feel luscious and wanted. In the blurred margins between role play and reality, in front of a classroom full of eighth graders, I decided I would start fucking Sean. 16 years later, Sean and I still resided in the same nebulous expanse between friend and fuck. We never discussed the sex we had, neither before nor after. This day would be no different. The end of 2012 was a dying clock, each second seemingly slower than the preceding one. I had 5 weeks before I was scheduled to move to California. By the time Terry died, it was agonizingly clear that nothing would keep me from throwing my body on top of and beneath anyone who might press out the grief. I was stringing together multiple states and placing them between me and every reckless decision I had made since the day the mortician handed me a pile of gray-white gravel and ash in a plastic bag, inside a square black container, placed in a white cardboard box heavy as a small toolkit, a box filled with a woman named Terry Hines, a woman I used to call Mommy. Driving to Sean's house in Philadelphia was an act of harm reduction, a last-ditch effort to kick the Jones for the person I most desperately desired to let destroy me, Quasi. For 3 years, I screwed Quasi to abandon myself, like my mother had abandoned me. I was at Sean's house for the same reason I would have gone to Quasi's, but Sean was a lesser drug, methadone instead of heroin. Regardless, every person I'd ever slept with was supposed to replace my mother. They did not. And tonight, I was going to let Sean inside me because my mommy was dead in every city of every nation on the planet, and that truth bulldozed me. Because she left me at center stage in all my shit and nothing to hold on to but her ashes. I slept with people, all sorts of people, because it was what I'd learned to do with a sorrow in the marrow of my bones. Try to disappear it. I was starving. Sean would feed me. Not this meal he was preparing, though it was a kind gesture. Food in the past 8 weeks had been reduced to a gauze-flavored substance people foisted on me, then watched me eat. Eating was the evidence I provided to concerned friends that I wasn't passively trying to follow Terry to wherever she had gone. No one seemed to realize I had been secretly following my mother's dead-end directions long before her earthly departure. The tinned blade of each day without her peeled me, raw and ravenous for any sensation to eclipse grief for even an hour. I shuffled the meal around on my plate and waited in agitation for the formality of dinner with Sean to end. He watched me in confusion. "Why aren't you eating?" "Damn, Sony, I have never seen you like this." "Sean, my mother is dead. How else would you expect me to be?" "Yeah, that's true." His considered tone intimated that perhaps he had forgotten that small detail. For all his debonair stylizing and feigned arrogance, it was obvious Sean felt minified and impotent beside the monument of sadness I had become. Grief had carved me into a new edifice, and grief had hollowed me out. We finished the meal in relative quiet, crawled into bed, and hit the light switch. Sean moved his hand toward me, disrupting the dark pocket of silence between us. A movement as predictable as death or love. He slid his cool palm inside the t-shirt he had given me to wear to bed. Another formality. Then grazed the tip of his index finger against my nipple. Here was the invitation I had come all this way for. A meal he'd offered me many times before. And without a word, I ate. The next morning, Sean made me coffee, poured it in a metal travel mug, and walked me downstairs to my car. His stiff hug was just as awkward as it had been for 16 years. "I hope you feel better." He held open the car door as I climbed inside. He turned toward his house and disappeared behind the paint-chipped white plywood door. I pulled out of the driveway and down his narrow street. By the time I got to the first stoplight, I was hungry again. Leaving a DC work meeting a few days after my visit with Sean and a week past Thanksgiving, I headed down New York Avenue toward Route 50 and the Baltimore-Washington Parkway, toward what should have been a straight shot home. Instead, I made a left-hand turn on Minnesota Avenue. This rerouting was as outside of any conscious machinations as blinking or swallowing. It was automatic. Going to Sean, feeding the hunger, had turned over an ignition inside me, one I had no key for. I was a revving engine, a car stuck in drive. I would not stop until I ran out of gas. Here I was, not wanting to, but nevertheless, driving north toward the DC neighborhood of Columbia Heights, toward Quasi. I looped 16th Street through Harvard Street with its shoddy and souped-up brick homes, set back far enough for the inhabitants to have fenced front yards, then drove back up 14th Street, past 7-Eleven and Target, then across Park Road and over to 16th Street again. I studied the profiles of Black men's faces in the dark along the way. "Is that a goatee?" "No, his beard is too thin." I examined their frames, quickly excluding those whose bodies rose above 6 feet. "His pants are too tight. He's walking too fast." I performed this ritual of circle and investigation, identification and elimination, no fewer than 10 times for the next hour, looking for Quasi. I finally pulled my car in front of Mark's Cafe off 16th Street, parked in the no parking zone, and screamed in outrage, "Fuck you!" to an entity that was both me and Quasi and God and no one. And the engine in me and me inside my car both sputtered and stalled, my tank finally empty. To the left of my car, the restaurant bar pulsed with strange bodies I could see through the glass front door. DC newcomers sipping Cuba Libres and taking swigs of craft beer under the Titian lights. Marks served as evidence of the ever-lightening complexion of Chocolate City. A white-owned, communist-themed bar in a brown neighborhood, indifferently belched up from the gut of gentrification without so much as an excuse me to anyone. My self-righteous judgment did not stop me from routinely sitting at that bar opposite Kwasi, watching the contours of his hands and mouth as he courted then swallowed his glass of Makers on the rocks, as I took deliberate sips of vodka tonic with a squeeze of lime, just before we ambled our way back to his attic or basement only a few blocks down the street. As was our cycle, Kwasi had stopped answering my calls shortly after I visited him with my mother's cremains in tow. He did as he said he would that day, fucked me like my husband, but he had no intentions of treating me as such. Initially, I feigned gratitude. His rejection was helping me prepare for my move. He was doing me a favor by extracting himself from my life. For the first few weeks after that, I made myself busy with online Bay Area house hunting, researching moving companies and being ambushed by sorrow nightly. When the hook of sadness hitched itself to my chest and towed me through the day, I would masturbate before bed to augment the pain with some facsimile too flat and gray to call pleasure, but better than the hook. Soon the facsimile rendered itself useless. The week it stopped working, I drove to Sean's house. I fed the beast, and now, outside the Marks Cafe, it would not stop growling at me from inside my own belly. I sat in the car, seething and buckled under my own lack of self-control. Even still, on a muted internal channel, I continued willing Kwasi to actualize off of 16th Street in my blurred field of vision. My phone rang abruptly. The sound of the ringtone physically hurt, an unwelcome auditory pinch that shoved me back into my body. I fumbled through my purse and answered. My therapist, Dr. Byron, was calling, as she did several times a week since my mother died, an extension of care far beyond her therapeutic duties. There had been a rotating cast of therapists over the years, a series of fits and starts that were as much a function of my unreadiness to face the emotional closet collapsing in real time under the weight of my self-delusion, as they were a result of a host of professional ineptitudes and mismatches. Neither my inability to cease sexual relations with Kwasi, nor my mother's unwinding thread of sanity chased by Seagram's gin, led me to the couch of the middle-aged, ginger-haired woman with long limbs and gracious eyes. Flight anxiety was what finally forced me into therapy in 2011. I began having full-on panic attacks prior to boarding planes. I took 2 flights a month on average, and much of my income depended on air travel. Not until my trauma began to edge itself into the territory of my fledgling economic security was I even remotely willing to peek at it. For the first year, I saw Dr. Byron weekly, mostly over video sessions, but she called daily the first 2 weeks after Terry died, when I was in Virginia. She talked to me for an hour as I stood in a public laundromat washing and folding the 13 loads of flea-infested, mildewed shirts, sheets, and socks left abandoned in my mother's laundry room, some sopping and soured in her broken washing machine. The fleas were the remaining evidence of the lonely desperation that compelled her to take in a stray dog a month before she died, a litany of beginnings and tragic endings. Dr. Byron accompanied me as I navigated the mundanities of death and the bureaucracy of dead people business. Later, I would share with her how death dragged madness out of me, how I sat on my bedroom floor for 2 hours, my hands plunged wrist deep into the container of ashes in my lap, how I felt possessed by a compulsion to scoop up 2 palms worth of my mommy's gravelly bone fragments and eat them, to be full with Terry. Dr. Byron was the only one who knew in graphic detail how I wanted to, was willing to, put anything in my mouth, anything in my body to fill up the nothing. Dr. Byron knew a part of me had died with my mother. She knew when I did not that a part of me needed to. "Hi, Sonia. How are you?" she said. "I don't know, Dr. Byron," I replied, jaw still tight with anger that my diablerie had not conjured up Quasi. I lied to everyone but her. Each week, she presented me with a bowl empty of reproof and teeming with grace. Despite my best efforts, I could not help but pour honesty into such a sacred container. It took me a year into our sessions before I could look her directly in the eyes. She would say, "You are lovable, Sonia." And I would bow my head like a serf at such an implausible idea. During an appointment, I told her I felt indomitably unlovable, that even she loved me only because I paid her. "No, Sonia," she said. "You pay me for my time. You do not pay me to love you. I choose to love you."